Two short syllables, gun law, can start an argument in the United States. We're of two minds about how strongly guns should be regulated, on a spectrum from no one should have them to everyone should carry one. There's a lot of room in the middle. A little research might help, and our first guest took part in a major piece of research on gun laws recently published. Dr. Michael Siegel is an MD at the Department of Community Health Services at the Boston University School of Public Health. He was taking part in the research that took a look at both gun laws and rates of homicide and suicide over a long period of time across the entire country. Dr. Siegel, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
So let's get some of the basics out of the way first. This is referred to as a panel study, which means what?
What that means is that we followed states over a period of 26 different years. So we had data on the laws in each state as well as the homicide rates in each state for each of these 26 years. And so that's called a panel of data, and we're basically able to look at changes in the laws over time to see whether there were corresponding changes in the homicide rates.
Was it always easy to make sure that you were comparing apples to apples? I mean, it seems like some categories of behavior are not necessarily tracked the same way in every place.
Well, it's a good point. Homicide is obviously a complex phenomenon, and so what we attempted to do was to control for as many variables that reflect differences across the states that we could think of. So we controlled for differences in violent crime rates other than homicide. We controlled for property crime rates. We controlled for socioeconomic factors. We controlled for differences in gun ownership rates across the states. And because we controlled for so many different variables, we believe that we were reasonably able to single out the impact of these gun laws.
So, Dr. Siegel, is this research that might have been done by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, except that CDC is blocked from doing that kind of work by the Dickey Amendment?
Well, this is exactly the kind of work that one would have expected the CDC to be doing over the last 20 years, really, if not for this Dickey Amendment, which basically has been interpreted to block the CDC from doing the research. And this is kind of why we stepped in. There was no federal agency that's doing this research, and so individual investigators really had to step in and do this themselves.
So it's you at Boston University, and where were the other researchers from?
So on this paper, we collaborated with researchers at the Harvard School of Public Health as well as other colleagues here from the Department of from the School of Public Health at Boston University, and also from the Department of Emergency Medicine over at Boston Children's Hospital.
Okay, so a couple different entities generally in the Boston area. In essence, you've got information from every state over a 26-year period?
Yeah, when we started this project, we started to look online to see if there are databases that we could use that had tracked state laws over the last few decades. And we actually found that there was no such database in existence, and so we actually had to start from scratch, and we created this database ourselves by kind of painstaking process of going through the laws of every state, literally reading through page by page in order to compile this database.
Wow, so the database was just for the laws, not for the statistics?
The database contains both the laws as well as I mentioned, these control variables, which we obtained. Those were, reasonably easy to obtain because many of them are, from the census or other publicly available data sources. But the state laws, really, we had to do ourselves because there was no existing database for that.
And so just an outline, was there a lot of movement on state gun laws over this 26-year period? We're talking 1991 to 2016.
There was a huge amount of movement. And I think it's important to note, though, that the movement was not uniform across the states. And in fact, what we observed was that states that already had a fair number of gun laws in 1991, like California, for example, adopted a large number of those new laws during the study period. And states that started out with a very small number of laws really didn't adopt that many new laws, with a few exceptions.
So the trends, it sounds like, continued. If it was a fairly gun-friendly state in the first place, it sounds like it was going to stay friendly, if not get friendlier. And conversely, if it was a state that had some fair restrictions on guns, it was likely to put more in place.
Exactly. And what we've really observed is kind of a growing divide between the states, where the discrepancy between the state with the least laws and the state with the most laws is getting larger and larger over time.
So here again, a great division. There's not a lot of middle ground, it sounds like.
That's exactly right. There's states that have a small amount of laws and states that have many laws, and there isn't a lot of room in the middle.
We're talking to Dr. Michael Siegel in the Department of Community Health Sciences at the Boston University School of Public Health. He's involved with a long bit of research, or a broad bit of research, called The Impact of State Firearm Laws on Homicide and Suicide Deaths in the USA, 1991 to 2016, a panel study. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about gun laws in correlation with suicide and homicide rates. They're clear to point out it is not causality, for sure, but there is correlation. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. One of the approaches you talk about, and just in methodology in the paper, is that you used a difference in differences approach. That bears some discussion.
Yeah, so what we looked for were changes in the homicide rates after the adoption of a law. And so the problem with doing this kind of research is that it's possible that the states that pass laws are laws that are already starting out with lower homicide rates. And so if you just look at the relationship between whether or not a state has a law and what its homicide rate is, you may find a relationship that has nothing to do with the effect of the law, but is just due to the fact that those states are more likely to pass laws. So what we did was look not at the absolute level of the homicide rate, but we looked only at the changes in the homicide rates from year to year. And in our results, we basically found that there were several laws that actually changed the homicide rate significantly over time.
You say that the laws appear to have changed the results?
Exactly. So in other words, we found that even after you control for the changes in homicide rates that occurred in other states, there were three laws that we found that were associated with a significant change in the homicide rate in the states in which they were enacted. And we also found some laws that weren't, that had no association. And what we tried to do was to kind of take the results and to come to some general conclusions about the types of laws that seem to be effective and the types of laws that don't seem to be quite as effective.
So you ended up with three that did appear to have an effect, but how many did you look at overall?
We looked at a total of 10 different types of state laws, and we found three that were that appeared to be effective and the others weren't. And to kind of summarize, I think what we found is that laws that regulate who has access to firearms, so specifically laws that either require universal background checks to make sure that people don't have a criminal history, or laws that make sure that someone who already has a history of violence cannot obtain a firearm, those laws were associated with significantly lower homicide rates. Laws that regulate what we call the what, kind of the types of firearms that are allowable on the market, those laws didn't seem to have any impact on homicides. And so what we think is going on here is that, you know, the guns are basically universally fatal, and so the types of guns that are allowable aren't going to have a big impact, even though you hear a lot about assault weapons, and because it's really the mass shootings that frankly get all the media attention. But the overwhelming majority, 99.9% of homicides that occur, are not part of mass shootings. They're really everyday homicides that occur, and those are not going to be prevented by getting rid of so-called assault weapons. From day to day, the laws that seem to have the greatest impact are laws that take people who are at the greatest risk of violence, situations where you have somebody who has actually committed an act of violence in the past, and prohibits them from possessing a weapon.
I was going to ask about the assault weapons thing, because it sounded like that's where you were going, and it was indeed. So the laws that regulate the kind of gun don't appear to have a correlation.
That's exactly right. And I think that the lesson here that this is what this is suggesting to us, and again, this is preliminary research, and we definitely need more research to confirm this, but at least the initial lesson here seems to be that, you know, there is a lot of attention that these mass shootings get, and it leads many public health advocates to focus on the idea of, you know, let's ban assault weapons, let's get rid of these weapons that look like they're military or that simulate military weapons. And while that certainly, you know, sounds good and may make sense to people, what our research shows is that's not really going to have a significant impact on population rates of homicides. The laws that really we think are going to make the most difference are laws that intervene in the most high-risk situations where someone has committed an act of violence, situations where, for example, someone has committed domestic violence, or someone is subject to a restraining order, or there's some other red flag that puts a person at high risk. And if we intervene in those situations, it appears that we can have a huge impact. In fact, we found that states that have all three of the laws that I mentioned, those states actually experienced 35% lower homicide rates. So we think there is a huge proportion of homicides that could be prevented if all states were to implement even just these three laws alone.
Dr. Michael Siegel, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange in the Department of Community Health Sciences at the Boston University School of Public Health. And we are talking about research that he took part in that looked at homicide and suicide rates and gun laws in all 50 states across 26 years from 1991 to 2016. So a very, very broad study. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, offer your thoughts on how we should be interpreting this data or what you think about the situation generally. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Now, in the key results section of your study, you write three major subsets, which we've touched on briefly here: universal background checks, violent misdemeanor laws, and shall issue laws. It looks like the violent misdemeanor laws has the strongest association with reduction in homicide rates.
Well, that's exactly right. We found that states that have these violent misdemeanor laws actually experience an 18% lower homicide rates than states that don't have that law. And, you know, the reason why this is important is that federal law makes a felony, any felony crime, you are not allowed to possess a firearm under federal law. But if you commit a violent crime, it could be an assault, battery, but it falls short of being prosecuted as a felony, and it's only at the level of a misdemeanor. In most states, you are still allowed to carry a weapon. And what we're finding is that states that fill that loophole by basically saying, look, if you commit a violent crime, we don't care if it's getting prosecuted as a felony or as a misdemeanor. The point is you've committed a violent assault of some sort, and that is a high risk for future violence. We don't want you carrying a gun. Those laws alone seem to be associated with a huge reduction in homicide. And so that loophole is actually quite an enormous one, and one that really the states are going to need to fill because federal law has that gaping loophole in it.
I wonder how big that specific data set was, though, Dr. Siegel. I mean, how many states have these violent misdemeanor laws that will prevent people from owning guns because they've committed a violent misdemeanor?
Well, right now, believe it or not, there are only about 5 states in the country that have laws that automatically prohibit people who've committed a violent misdemeanor from possessing a firearm. There are a much larger number of states, close to 24, that prohibit people with a domestic violence-related violent crime from possessing a gun. So in the domestic violence setting, there are quite a few states that have kind of closed that loophole. But with respect to other types of violent crimes, very few states actually have an explicit prohibition against carrying weapons. There are a number of states, about 13 states, which have these what we call may issue laws as opposed to shall issue. And what that means is that the police have the discretion to deny a concealed carry permit to a person who has a violent misdemeanor, even though it doesn't rise to the level of a felony. And so we're finding that that law itself is associated with 9% lower homicide rates. So no matter how you come at it, if you try to close this loophole by either giving police discretion to deny permits to people who have a history of violence or by explicitly banning the possession of firearms by people with a history of violence, you seem to be able to reduce the homicide rate by a significant amount.
Now, you said May issue laws showed a 9% decrease in homicide?
Exactly.
But the shall issue laws, on the other hand, show a 9% increase in homicide. Is that right?
Right. So it's basically the same thing, because essentially what we're showing is that if you have a shall issue law, if you were to implement a shall issue law, you would expect the homicide rate to be 9% higher. And so the converse is also true. If you switch to a May issue law, you would expect it to be 9% lower.
And just to be clear in terminology, the law says the sheriff shall issue a concealed carry permit, that sort of thing?
Exactly. So shall issue law, the sheriffs and or police officers don't have any discretion. If the person is not a convicted felon or doesn't meet other specific criteria that are spelled out, they must be given the permit, even if the sheriff knows that the person has a history of a violent crime or knows something else about the applicant that would raise serious red flags and make the police chief think that this person is not an appropriate person to have a firearm, they must essentially ignore that and issue these permits anyway. Whereas the May issue laws allow the police chiefs to basically deny permits on the basis of knowledge that a person is at high risk.
Michael Siegel's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an MD at the Department of Community Health Sciences at the Boston University School of Public Health, one of a team of researchers that looked at all 50 states for 26 years at firearm law impacts on homicides and suicide deaths across the country. You can join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from John and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hi. I'm remembering a controversy that arose when they tried to close these kinds of loopholes, maybe closer to the 26-year beginning of these studies. Police have so often they're domestic abusers, and when they first implemented some of these laws, they hadn't thought of that, and suddenly, by law, they had to disarm the police, and so an exception was made. That's my recollection. Can you speak to that?
Hang on a second, Jeff. So you say so often domestic abuse. Is that a fair statement about police generally?
Very often, you know, just like in characterized in the movies where they get home and drink and trying to forget the struggles they've had to involve themselves with professionally, and there's a lot of domestic abuse, is my understanding.
All right, that bears discussion in the future. Thanks for that, John. I want to get Michael's thoughts on what he just heard.
Well, I'm not aware of evidence that has looked at police officers specifically to see whether or not rates of domestic violence are higher. I'm certainly not aware of any evidence for that. But I think it's fair to say that that when you look at society as a whole, the people who are at greatest risk for violence in the future are people who already have a history of violence. Domestic violence offenses are a significant risk factor for future violence, and there's a lot of research which basically shows that that domestic violence or violence in general is the greatest predictor, and it's a much stronger predictor than other things that people might think are predictors. For example, mental illness is actually a very poor predictor of violence. People who have mental illness in general are no more likely to commit violence than anyone else. What you really want to look at, if you want to know the greatest risk factor for violence, is people who have a history of violence. And so I think that's really where the attention needs to be for state lawmakers who really want to put a dent in these homicide rates.
Let me give the key results again from this study. Universal background checks were associated with a 14.9% reduction in overall homicide rates. Violent misdemeanor laws associated with an 18.1% reduction in homicide, and shall issue laws were associated with a 9% increase in homicide. You say this several times over the course of the study. You did not establish causality here.
Right. We can't be absolutely certain, especially from just one single study, that that these laws are causally associated with the outcome. And the main reason for that is simply that it is possible that states that have these laws are more likely to have characteristics that one would have expected would lead to lower homicide rates anyway without the laws. With that said, though, we did control for a large number of variables that would predict homicide rates, and we were able to explain a huge amount of the variation across states in homicide rates, about 90% of that variation. So the chances that there is some sort of variable that we're missing here that explains the relationship seems rather low. Nevertheless, you know, you always want to have multiple studies before you draw definitive conclusions.
I noticed, Dr. Siegel, you're a tobacco control expert, and I wonder if you find similarities between tobacco and firearm marketing.
There are a lot of similarities between the two industries. I think the biggest similarity that we've found is that both industries are trying to create a perception that there is a huge public divide. So for the tobacco industry, they basically tried to convince the public that there was a huge divide between smokers and non-smokers, and they spent a lot of money supporting smokers' rights groups. The gun industry is doing the same thing. They're trying to create this idea that somehow, you know, there's two types of people in society. There are gun owners and people who don't own guns. And we think this is really an artificial and unnecessary divide. We believe that both gun owners and non-gun owners have the same values. Nobody wants to see higher homicide rates. Everyone has the same goal. And in fact, when you look at public opinion polls, the majority of gun owners support the types of laws we're talking about. The latest poll showed that 90% of gun owners support universal background checks. And so we believe that there is a lot more perceived division in society than there actually is when you actually talk to people. And we're hoping that common ground can be taken advantage of to support policies that will really have an impact. And we also think that perhaps by shying away from and not focusing or obsessing on policies that do require taking guns away from certain types of guns away from firearm owners, that they will feel less alienated and more likely to engage in helping to find a solution for this problem.
Just to restate what you said earlier, then, it really matters more who has access to guns than what guns they have access to. So that's one of the takeaways certainly here. The study title is The Impact of State Firearm Laws on Homicide and Suicide Deaths in the USA, 1991 to 2016, a panel study, a lot of work by several researchers, including our guest, Dr. Michael Siegel, Department of Community Health Services, Boston University School of Public Health. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.
Sure, take it easy.